It's all right. I can go again.
Chair Garrett, I'm going to have to leave early, so just so you know.
Can I gavel again just for fun? Good evening. We'll call to order the Joint Committee on Public Safety for Wednesday, March 20, 2013. We will first open an informational meeting on House Bill 3259, and Mr. Nasby will give us a brief explanation of that, and then Representative Hicks will share some thoughts.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. House Bill 3259 comes from you from Representative Hicks, and like all of the bills that have been before the committee this session, it tackles quite a few subjects. I think in the interest of time, I'm only going to spend time describing three of them because those are the places where I think the differences between the bills are the clearest. And I'll go sort of in reverse order here. So there's a program evaluation piece that requires the Department of Corrections to maintain a registry of their inmate-related programs, and it directs the department to conduct randomized controlled trials of those programs. The second significant difference involves transitional leave. It's under House Bill 3259, it remains a 30-day transitional leave, but it becomes available for all offenders upon completion of all eligible offenders upon completion of the inmate's release plan. And then the third significant difference involves post-prison supervision. And with the Dash 1 amendments to the bill, the Dash 1 amendments establish a post-prison supervision reentry court where persons convicted of a felony can be sentenced to participate in the reentry court upon their release from prison. And I think significantly, the Dash 1 amendments are designed. The reentry court is designed as a grant program, so it doesn't, it's not a requirement, but it's one of the programs for which a county could receive a grant and implement a reentry court. And so with that, I think I'll turn it over to the representative unless there are questions.
Please go ahead. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a few comments. I do urge the committee to not put cost or dollar figures or anything related to that at the forefront of your mind just yet.
Ding, ding, ding.
I am equally concerned as every single member of this committee with that very subject. I am also confident, highly confident, that these questions will be addressed during the due course of the presentation. But before they get to the dollar, and I think we're going to hit a part of it today. I think at least one of our witnesses will be able to address a significant portion of that. But I just ask the committee to keep an open mind as we peruse what this bill includes, and just have confidence that I am equally concerned about cost, and I think that it has been covered adequately in this bill. With that, let's.
All right. Thank you. We have two invited witnesses to speak to this bill. Let's ask Judge Aiken to come forward, please. Yeah, we'll bring Joe Piccinari up too as well.
Joe.
Welcome. Thanks for being here.
We'll start with Judge Aiken.
Let me introduce myself briefly. My name is Ann Aiken. I am a resident of Eugene. If you need my address, it's at the Wayne Morris Courthouse, U.S. District Court in Eugene. I'm a second-generation Oregonian, a product of all the public schools here. More importantly, I served almost 10 years on the Lane County Circuit Court, and I've served over 14 in the federal bench. So I bring you about 25 years of experience on the bench, and I think some thoughts about what we're doing in the federal system that may be illustrative and helpful to a really complicated problem, one that we all care a lot about because we all live in the community and we care about how we're going to address the complex issues of corrections and public safety. When I went to the federal bench, I'd like to just share with you just briefly how this became an interesting program. When I went to the federal bench, I learned very quickly that evidence-based practices was not a known concept for the federal courts. And in fact, what we were doing was we were having a huge methamphetamine problem, and we were recycling people as quickly as they could come out of the federal system right back into prison. And it was incredible failure, and the judges were up in arms. The probation staff was up in arms, and we were particularly concerned about how we were going to address these needs and issues. So we had a big summit over at Sheridan. We brought the state together, the feds, everyone, congressional office, legislators, and we looked at what are the strategies that we can do in the state of Oregon or in the federal system to better address high-risk offenders. In our federal court system, we do not have the low-risk offenders. This jurisdiction has one of the highest-risk offender populations in the communities, and those are the folks who are charged. So we don't have just, you know, easygoing kinds of people coming out of prison. We have the highest-risk offenders. And how can we do a better job in our communities? Out of that incredible summit came what was a concept known to those of us who've been in the state system as drug courts. We use drug courts because our goal was to recruit people coming out of prison voluntarily into a process where they would have intense supervision, evidence-based practices, and responses that comported with how the drug court models worked, and that was swift sanctions, incentives, and comprehensive drug and alcohol treatment to complement the other array of services and delivery for individual needs. What ended up taking place was sort of remarkable, and I'm going to walk real quickly. I want to show a couple of these slides. So I want to show this one.
We know there is urgency.
650,000 people every year are released from a jail or prison facility of some type. 650,000 people. I've been in the criminal justice field for 15 years, and that number shocked even me. That is a big number.
I was 32 when I came out. I went in when I was 17.
We owe it to ourselves to better prepare ourselves.
I'm just determined not to go back to prison.
It's not an easy road. You have to work for it.
You struggle long enough, you can eventually get something going.
Look where I am today. There's definitely a lot of hope.
We know we need to do something different.
They're coming back into the community regardless. The question is, as a system, do we bring them back with or without the ability to be successful?
Systems do a terrible job at taking care of people, of individuals. You just become a number and they just, you know, push you through.
We know what works.
The more I watched them and I really listened and I really understood after the first session of setting in that they actually cared.
Here I got the prosecutor, the judge, the PO. It's not how can we screw you or lock you up. It's what can we do to help you? What can we do to make your life a little more easier? I never had that.
We know nothing happens without leadership. Our communities are ready for change. It's time for a new era of leadership from the bench. This is not about activism. It's about leadership for our communities. Programs are already working around the country. We know there's urgency. We know what works. It's time to lead right now.
I show you that because that is a public-private partnership with Extreme Arts and Sciences, and they are an executive training organization that does work all over the country with Microsoft, Bluetooth, you name them. And they do amazing work in these institutions, and we partnered with them to take a look at our population and what do we need to do differently. And they were so astounded at what we were providing for the individuals that they came over, happened to do a video and another video for us that virtually, I would say, in a moment in time with sentencing guidelines in a position where the Supreme Court was bringing back discretion for the court, and the fact that we did the video, it went judicially viral. And so across the country, judges started to see that instead of just sending people back to prison, which was our only possibility, that we had the authority under the statute to set up reentry courts so that when people come out of prison, they are referred into a reentry court and they voluntarily sign a contract, come in and have intense supervision, much more difficult than supervision with a probation office, much more involved, much more strategy done with their cases, and we take using a risk assessment tool, the highest risk offenders. Because if you can make a difference with the highest risk offenders and keep them out of the jails and prisons and moving forward in a life's work and contributing, that's going to drive success for the next level of offender down. And that's exactly what we found out. This is the revolving door. Everybody knows it. Everybody's seen it. These are the numbers. What I will tell you is these are just rough numbers of populations. What's interesting is the incarceration rate is going down, but we're good, as you can see, the numbers of people coming back into the communities are going to go straight through the roof. And what I would suggest to you is coming out of prison without this kind of mechanism is setting people up for failure. They are, after 10, 15, 20 years, 9 years in prison, the world is very different, and they are, let me tell you, it's like being in a sociological setting every single month when we sit down and talk with people about what are the issues they're facing. This is on the federal side, and I would point out the federal offenders in Oregon have conviction rates of violence, 14.3% in Oregon versus 6% nationally, a higher risk population, and as well the issues of high-risk offenders. We have that population. We have moved to evidence-based practices. And, you know, you got to start somewhere. So we started with a small model in Eugene and a small model in Portland. And now Judge Hernandez, who's new on my court, been there a couple of years, he's gone to probation and said, we're going to build this to capacity up here, and we're going to expand it. I have Judge McShane coming on, I think, after a Senate floor vote shortly, totally committed to this program. We are going to build the models in a way that has the best strategies for these high-risk offenders. So that sets out the expectations. This is what we have. It's an ecological model, and it's based on, for those of you who know me, you know I care a lot about the relief nursery. This is conceptually very much the same, only at the back end with offenders, and that is figuring out, building a trust relationship, building a long-term ability to find out what are the barriers that get in the way of their success and knocking them down. And what's been very successful is to use a combination of these tools, not just say, we have to have all this, you have to have all that. We make an individualized service delivery plan and then hold people accountable. As you can see, this is a chart. I know that's been shown many times from the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. Surveillance only, as you can see, you don't really get results. Surveillance coupled with treatment, some results. But when we have surveillance coupled treatment coupled with risk need assessment and responsivity, responsivity means what are you going to do when you know there's a criminogenic problem? What's your strategy? Our strategy, very frankly, has been an amazing education tool in addressing learning disabilities. And if you want to talk about what we could do for education, you ought to sit in my reentry classroom, in my courtroom, and watch what education didn't provide and where we are readdressing some of those issues. What's really important is from a federal standpoint, this is one of three pillars of Attorney General Holder's department from the Attorney General's perspective. He speaks about it nonstop because we cannot incarcerate everyone, and we have to bring people back thoughtfully. They have put together, this is the cabinet-level team that works on these issues. They meet monthly. We're trying to coordinate services at a national level, and everybody is represented and is not just a four-show committee. They are incredibly hardworking, and we have a lot of contact with strategies to address very particular needs. For example, I have a guy graduating tomorrow, and the prison told him the wrong information about signing up for Social Security and Medicaid. So we've used his case model as a chance to write a paper up to the Council for the Bureau of Prisons and to address across the country issues that are getting in the way of people being able to access the federal benefits that they are entitled to. So it is this incredible dynamic back and forth work, and my hat goes off to not only Attorney General Holder, but also to the new director of the Bureau of Prisons, Charles Samuels, who was a program director, and he is been sensational in working out with us. So in 2002, there was a little program in New York. Judge Sifton sort of quietly did this on his own, and we heard a little bit about it. But, you know, those of us who'd come over from the state court said, I don't know why we're not using a different strategy that we had available to us in the state system, and that is incentives always work better than just sticks. So this is where we are in 2008. And this is where we are in 2012. This has grown judge to judge. because we are really simply tired of failing and sending people back to prison. It is very expensive, and it is a tremendous waste. And so across the country, there's an incredible network of probation chiefs and judges who are all doing model programs to make a difference, and it's being supported because it's making a difference. We have a national study underway that will document some of this, and each of us are in our own districts are doing much more with data. When I first went to the federal system, we didn't even have the ability to have computerized data. We do now, and we're starting to mine that data. What I would tell you is if you've read Jeffrey Kennedy's book, Whatever It Takes, with the Harlem Children's Zone, they count children in the third grade for prisons. And my mantra for this entire process in the federal system is, could we stop and could we count children for higher education instead? I went down last week. This little slideshow was to speak to 400 of the high-end software folks, big law and entrepreneurial conference, Reinvent Law, Silicon Valley, and I said, this is a call to action for the community. In our reentry program, we have at the table all the community resources, and we use those strategies, and we build off what we know in the community's works, whether it's jobs, Lane Community College, our education system, whether it's medical care using Medical Bridge Acts, child care, relief nurseries, committed partners for youth, whatever strategy we need to help people stay succeeding in a position not going back into prison we use. So I said to them what I really wanted was the following. I want a software device developed where it's, boom, you hit, if you have help needed, you can't say to a drug addict, could you wait till Thursday at 4:30? I have an opening then. People need responsivity, and they need it now. So my hope is that someone will, I have like 10 business cards from software engineers who all made more money than you know any of us would spend in a lifetime looking for the next problems to solve. So that's why I was given the opportunity along with Mark Sherman from the Federal Judicial Center to talk about how we might partner differently. And then you just you plug in this phone and you download the data, and we start doing what we're doing in the federal system, which is we're spending our money very strategically on the highest risk offenders, and we're using strategies that are evidence-based and documented to make a difference. So in what we talk about all the time is you got to know hope. You have to find out by sitting in the rooms with some of the individuals that we see, our high-risk offenders, and understand that there's a lot of hope when you spend time working with people. And what I applaud in the legislation is we're missing in the state of Oregon what I so loved when I sat on the state court bench, and that is the ability to make a difference with the people coming out of prison. When I was growing up in Salem, I'm from here, my father put a project together, and we rebuilt Leslie Gym with the Lifers Club. So I worked hand in glove with inmates, and so I think that can tell you a great deal about where we are now as opposed to where we were then. Those folks were going, they came and did the work, and then they go back to prison, and they were going to be there for their life. Most of the people we're talking about are coming back into our communities. And I can tell you whether it's a judge, Carol Jackson in East St. Louis, or Ruben Castillo in Chicago, or Otis Wright in L.A., or Leo Sorokin in Boston, or Burl Schiller in Philadelphia, we are all committed that we have to take back, in many ways, the ability to make a difference. The state court judges, I would argue, are in that same position to make a big difference. What if you look at the data, if you look at how drug courts are assembled and you look at the components that go together to make a successful program, it took me a while to really understand it, but the judge has an enormous power, and it's good power. There's a great deal to be said for that accountability, having the judge spend time in the room with these high-risk offenders, sit at the side, and hold them accountable. And I can tell you, if you sat in the court, you would understand that. So in the state of Oregon, that the judges are removed from that process, so when people come out of the system, you're not only left without having that ability to have them understand what's needed, but you don't have the advocates for how the system really needs to evolve. And that's, I think, a really missing component in how this is done. Do I think judges are overburdened and doing too much in the state system? It was the best job I had. I loved the state court. I can only tell you I loved the amount of work, but I think we all feed on success, and there's such an opportunity to, right now in a financial crisis, to do more with less, to be strategic, to bring different people to the table, and I think you'd find The court is an interesting party to partner with, as you do maybe perhaps a model, or you take a look at starting somewhere, as we did in the federal system. We started with a model. We built from that model. We built from the success of that model. And I would tell you, we started in 2006. I think maybe I've missed two sessions in that number of years. We meet every month. At the table, just to know, is the U.S. Attorney representative, the probation officer runs the program, the defense counsel is assigned, usually an investigator. I happen to have an investigator, a former law enforcement individual, treatment providers in the room, and any other auxiliary services. We have people on waiting lists to get in, and we meet monthly. And there's a handout, so we know exactly how people have done during the month. And we go through, and it's a very dynamic process where we address needs. And our mantra is, what do you need? What do you need from us to help be successful the next 30 days? So what I will tell you is people say, oh, that's maybe hug a judge or too soft on people. We set such a high bar for our folks. It's incredible, and they meet it. And that's number one. And number two, I can tell you, I catch people who are going sideways faster than the regular system because I see them every month. So I can identify when those folks are starting to go back into using drugs or drug-seeking behavior or have problems, we can identify it. So it's probably one of the most successful strategies for addressing recidivism. And that's our goal. All of this is about eliminating the recidivism from our system and to keep people out in the communities, holding jobs, being successful, paying taxes, because simply the costs are astronomical now. And in the federal system, just as in the state system, we're being bankrupted by them. And so this movement across the country, I think, speaks volumes to what would be a tremendous opportunity in Oregon for us to partner again, state and federally, to leverage the resources. Because very truthfully, with the numbers we have in Oregon, without the infrastructure from the state system, we don't have a delivery of drug and alcohol treatment. We don't have the services available because we can't buy them on our own. So we do need to partner, and we do need to figure out how to address the highest risk offenders that go back and forth between the state and the federal system. So I know it's a very difficult time to address these issues, but, you know, it was a really difficult time when we took this on in the federal system. And I think for all of us, we're incredibly grateful that we just sat down and said, where do we start, and let's try, and let's see if we can't be effective. And I think what's happened, the growth, speaks for itself. So thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you for your time. We really appreciate you taking time to be here. Any questions for Judge Aiken?
No. Go ahead.
Sam Hicks, go ahead.
Do reentry courts save tax dollars within the justice system?
No question. I mean, you can talk about the lack of you having to use prison space. What was happening with our caseload, I couldn't believe it. They would come back out of prison. They would have three tries before a probation officer. If they used once, they'd get a sanction in the probation office because the court wasn't involved. It was the probation office. They get a second use, and then maybe something else would happen. The third time, they'd be in front of the judge, and we'd just simply revoke, send them back to prison. So I said, this doesn't make any sense. What are we doing? And I went back down to, we went down to probation, and then we started building the strategies of when somebody's using, it's a symptom. So our design, our entire design on reentry is a medical model teamed with using when people choose drug and alcohol or make some mistakes, that's a symptom of something else going on. So we are able to target that symptom and address it either with a sanction, a short sanction in a jail space, which we work out with the Lane County Jail, or we work out with Multnomah County, short sanction, community service, other strategies, or upping treatment or changing a housing situation or finding out what's happening at work. So we are keeping people out of institutions, and we are moving them through jobs. The other exciting piece about reentry is when you work with the employers, they get a tax credit for employing someone who's on in a reentry program or has a felony offense. So we work with felon-friendly employers. most importantly, once they get a job, the turnover is what costs business their money. So our support with the reentry program keeps people in their job and helps them address the myriad of other issues that can get in the way of people's success. And so we work hand in glove with the employers so that they have this, they train people to get into, you know, amazing jobs, and then, boom, if their family falls apart and they don't have enough support to address an issue, they lose their job, the employer is out an employee. We've had tremendous response. So it's a win-win for the community. And, in fact, Randy Harrington, who helped do this video for us, called me once from Tennessee, and he said, you know, Judge, Toyota is here. They want to have a plant. They can't get enough skilled employed workers. They're thinking about going over to the prison to make a deal with the prison. Do you know a judge down here who might run a reentry court so there's some accountability? And so that's the kind, those are the kind of calls we're getting, because if you look at the population in prisons right now, those are some of the skills that we need in the work world right now, and they're sitting in institutions. Because when they've come out and we've done the work with our assessment, our educational assessment as an incentive, we're finding people who just simply have the skills that made it impossible for them to be in school. So we marry up their skill sets with their job, or we marry it up with where they can go into a community college setting and bring skills up so the individual is then able to go to work and be successful. And I would tell you, as an aside, we've used this test and it's been very, very successful. We've identified two flat-out geniuses, both of whom had issues that we were able to address, one who could not auditorily process and the other one had mental health issues. And once we were able to address the mental health issues, we've been able to get him not only back working but in school, and I think he's going to end up with probably a full ride to Oregon State. So there are a lot of little gold nuggets that if you just spend the time understanding why something went wrong, we're able to take these high-risk offenders and turn them into productive individuals. As a last aside, I would tell you to take a look at Dateline this last Sunday. When Dwight Holton was the acting U.S. attorney, we've had probably 50 districts come look at our model and go back and set up. We consult around, you know, whether it's Florida, Chicago, wherever. But Dwight Holton brought 5 U.S. attorneys, including the U.S. attorney who chairs the Attorney General's Reentry Council, and he was on Dateline last Sunday with his program, which is a different iteration of what we're doing. But that's the beauty of this program, is it's all the components in evidence-based practices, but you could take it back and make it work for your community. And that's what we've been able to help other districts do. Long answer, but...
Can I do one more?
Yes.
And so does education, does it factor into your reentry court model?
Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, one of the things we're working, I have to give it again another shout out to Director of Bureau of Prisons, Charles Samuels. He has a new warden here at Sheridan, Marion Feather, and really tremendous commitment to programs in education. He's an educator. He came up through the ranks. He understands we need to do that. And so our goal is to build enough trust to then test and be able to help people go in successfully. It doesn't work if you just send somebody back into an education setting if you've not addressed why they were failing to begin with. So we use this assessment tool that was a talented and gifted screening tool to give people the chance to look at how you can plot an education chart that gives them a chance to be successful and then build on their strengths. Some people, their deficits are enormous in some cases, and we deal with those. But they, for the first time, maybe understand why they've had the issues they've had. But they're going to either work as a part of the reentry program or they're going to be in school. And I've had more than my share of guys coming in with straight-A report cards and the support they've never had.
Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Judge Aikens, and thank you for being here. Appreciate you taking time out of your schedule. Since we've heard a little bit about your program, maybe it might help us to have a little bit more information, understand that you meet with your probationers once a month.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of tell us your staffing, who you have, how many people you have available to help, like the POs, and then your team, so we can kind of get a concept of what that would be?
Well, of course, nobody gave us any money to do this, so I'd just like to say this was all done because what we have set up in the probation office is an evidence-based practice working group. In other words, because we use risk assessments, we target individuals by their risk assessments, so that the high-risk offenders are the ones we're targeting. The referrals are made by the probation office, by the U.S. attorney, by self-referral by defense attorneys, and then it's they sign off on a memo of understanding and agreement to come into the program and agree to a number of ability for me to sanction on the spot, which is what I do. I have assigned a probation officer who has a high-risk caseload along with the reentry caseload, one probation officer, and then there's a U.S. attorney assigned to be part of the team, and there's a defense attorney who's assigned, Brian Leslie and Bud Fitzgerald, and then Tony Pisani, who's a former law enforcement officer, now an investigator, is what I call the utility infielder in between, and she is the individual when there's, you know, let me give you an example. Most of our guys are coming out and have a suspended driver's license or no driver's license and a zillion tickets and money owed everywhere. And we sit down and teach them how to go about finding out what they owe and how to start making payments. You know, what's the restitution? So that takes a little hands-on work, and Tony Pisani plays that role as does the probation officer. And then we have the treatments through our contracts. We refer people out for inpatient or mostly it's outpatient treatment, and then they have to be engaged in school or work. There's a lot of bringing people to the point where they become self-motivated because they, for the first time, have that kind of support. But we've decided within our court and within the probation office that it's important enough for us to target these high-risk offenders and to give them that attention to move them out. It's spread between people who come in and say, we're going to sign up, we'd like to do this program, and the incentive is they'll get 1 year off their supervised release at the end of the day. Well, a judge can do that if somebody's doing well for any person in the federal system. It's the incentive to get them in. But once they're in, but what they tell us is we're here because you're helping us have a life. And so we've actually ended up having folks stick around, and they come back and come back and come back because this is their base. Women are more complicated. That's been a really interesting dynamic to up our services and to reach out and have everybody understand the breadth of community services they have to access, and to understand that government can't do it all. This is a public-private partnership, and that we go out and get community leaders to come in and help us where we have particular problems. Lane Community College, we run every one of our guys has a dental screening now and has dental work and ends up with a priority. Every one of our people have access to a free Y membership. We think health and working out and getting healthy and knowing having a place to go is important. And then we've done pro-social activities when they can't get jobs. And we built a huge garden about 3 years ago, 2.3 acres. And we worked on it every weekend, and we worked on it every night. And we probably provided more food for the community out of that garden and taught people responsibility that we're back doing a program now with Lane where we have a series of classes to life skill kinds of classes to remind them, you know, that it's life's hard, life's a journey. It's not just quick to sell some drugs and move on. They're going to get caught. So it's really a life skills process. So,
good. If I can follow up.
So
hearing that, you it sounds like part of it, at least to start off with, is incentive based, letting them know that if they come in, they do well, they're going to get something out of it, kind of reward.
Yep.
Then we know
tomorrow I'm going to graduate a guy who is. He'll graduate. He's on supervised release till probably 2016. He'll get a year off. 2015, he'll still be in our court. He's going to come to reentry period for the rest of his time. He was on America's Most Wanted. He was a huge drug dealer running drugs to Colombia and sitting over in, I think he was in Europe when he saw that on the air and was arrested. He's been an unbelievable turnaround, not only in the prisons, but with drug and alcohol treatment through the prison system and education. But coming out, he's been unbelievable in terms of understanding what it really takes for some of our younger guys to be successful.
So, and we've worked together on a number of issues. We try to, like say, partner up with having the state and the feds. We've had meetings up here on that. You're very familiar with the sponsors program.
Absolutely.
First of all, do you have any of your probationers that are actually utilizing?
Yep, they use. I mean, sponsors, I can't say enough nice things about sponsors, and I'm so grateful they're in the community, and I just wish we had more resources to buy more space, more beds for our people. But we participate in their mentoring program. We participate in, we have probably four people living out there right now, and they actually give back some service. We've done mutual programs. We're doing an education program with sponsors. It has to partner up. The services, we don't have enough for our people. Our numbers are smaller than the state, without question. But where we can partner up and where we can bring something to the table for the state system and we can trade back for our people, because we have access to a group like sponsors, there's a way for us to target those highest risk offenders that are crossing both jurisdictions and costing both jurisdictions a great deal of money. So I think there are any number of ways to partner with the feds. The other piece for us is when the Attorney General gives out the burn grants, those grants that go out that are a big deal to the state to get, well, we can't apply. And we can't even be a match to a community to apply. So when Lane County went after the burn grant for sponsors, we couldn't match up, although we were writing letters in support, but I was able to go get a private sector partner that helped provide a match for sponsors so that we could have some access. So we're always trying to figure out how to provide a holistic approach to folks that doesn't leave them hanging with the most important resource, whether it's housing, food, mental health care, safety net for their medical needs or family needs.
So if I could just follow up a couple more. So reentry programs, is key for success, mm-hmm. having somewhere that they can land, having this intense supervision, mm-hmm. and then holding them accountable through that process.
Absolutely. It's accountability and hope. That's what sentencing is all about. The hope piece has to be we have to have something when we send them out of prison. I've sat in a room with these guys when they break down, going in to buy groceries, coming out and they can't access things on a computer. They don't even know what we're talking about half the time. Get connected and taking them out to Lane Community College. I'll have guys who have anxiety attacks because it's overwhelming to go out there and know how to communicate or to address those needs. So when you start seeing the light go on in their eyes, and that they're making the difference for themselves, things they've never had before, it's truly gives you a lot of hope about what's possible with the myriad of prisoners that are going to be coming out. And as I've told people, I walk my neighborhoods, I live in my community. I would rather work as hard as I can to bring people back successfully from prison and let them know they're wanted than to have them come out from a very difficult experience and have no place to go. It's dangerous for the community. This is a very, very public safety-driven program because we build relationships. And coming out, you have that laser moment in time with people coming out of prisons. Sponsors, I mean, I've been involved with sponsors since Sister Janice was operating out of a small building and didn't have anything.
That name in a long time.
It's a fabulous, it's a national model. But you've got to have in that laser moment of time somebody who cares enough to bring somebody and say, you can do this. Here, for us, what a great incentive to keep from sending people back to the most expensive resource, which is a federal prison bed. And if we can move a chunk of people off, I'm hopeful at some point we will change how we fund things. Because I think what we do is we fund failure. We're too busy. We're overcrowded. Oh, my God. I would like to say when we're doing really excellent work, and you provide an incentive. So if we were succeeding with our population and we get more people off supervised release because they're succeeding, the federal government cuts us. I think they should give us additional resources to say, okay, what's the next evidence-based practice that should be put in place that would be successful? It's entrepreneurial. It's much more strategic. It empowers people to be successful, and incentives are what work. It took a year for the memo of understanding to be written between the U.S. attorney, the public defender, the courts, and probation. A year. I sat back and smiled to myself, having done this in the state system, and I said, I don't really care about the sanctions. The sanctions aren't there. These guys could go to prison and stand on their heads. It's the incentives. It's what can I do? What can I get them into a child care facility where their kids are getting the care that they didn't get when they were at home? Can I get them into an education program? Can I find through the bridge program at Sacred Heart, can I get the guy hernia surgery so he can actually go to work? Can we get somebody whose teeth have all been pulled in prison and sent to a halfway house? Can I get them dentures? Can I get them the idea that the if they come out, the community will do what we're supposed to do, and that is allow them to have paid their debt to society and come back and be successful. That's our obligation. That's what Winston Churchill talked about, a civilized society, one that allows people to pay their debt by going to prison, paying that pound of flesh, and then coming out and being able to return to the community and be successful. And if you sat in those rooms with the individuals, and I have sat there, and it's their time, it humbles you. It humbles you as a person who has access to resources, how hard we make it for people coming out, how hard it is to be successful, and then we wonder why they're not. I have been grateful for what I have learned from how hard it is. And they're not all going to be successful. I am not a fool. I have sentenced high-risk offenders. I've had any number of cases that I've sent people away for the rest of their lives. I understand that. But we are losing marginal people who we can really make a difference with. And there, by the grace of God, could any of us go with, you know, late onset of adolescent schizophrenia. Bipolar. Make some bad mistakes with bipolar. We're filling our prisons with bipolar and schizophrenia and mental health cases, and we're wondering why we have big problems. We just need different strategies. And what I would say to you, you know, now is as good a time as any to start doing something differently and to partner up with us. And it's not going to be perfect, but I think that if you incentivize the strategies, I think you'll find judges and probation officers and law enforcement and medical community, we would all like to do it differently because it costs us all a great deal to send people to prison.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Judge. We want to turn to Mr. Pichinieri now.
Go ahead.
If I can switch with you, I have a PowerPoint.
Oh, you have PowerPoint here. Sure. Absolutely. All right.
Yes. So while they're setting up, so I just want to highlight, so, and the judge has referenced many, many things, but she did reference at one point how important education and workforce development were to the whole system. And so here we have the gentleman who runs the Lane County Education Workforce Development Program. And so I'm just going to leave it at that. He's going to put his presentation out there, but this is, in my mind, part and parcel.
This is Joe.
This is Joe.
This is Joe.
Joe.
Wow. Joe. I'm not sure how I can follow that. So
you can't just. No.
I didn't think so.
Move on. Representative Hicks's elaborate introduction wasn't enough. You actually have to identify yourself for the record, please.
It's great to know so many of you. My name is Joe Pichinieri. I'm a deputy sheriff with the Lane County Sheriff's Office. I've been with the sheriff's office for a little over. My address is.
No, you don't need. Don't
give
your address.
You don't need to give
okay.
We can find you.
I'm sure of that. I've been a deputy sheriff for a little over 27 years, and I'm an advanced certified corrections officer, and I'm an advanced certified police officer, so I've worked on both sides of enforcement and incarceration. And actually, as it may be of worth some notice that for the last 8 years, I finished my last four-year term as a Springfield City Councilor, so I have some background in regards to administration and that end of things. So what I'd like to do is thank you again for inviting me here tonight. I really appreciate it. What I'd like to do is discuss at least let you know or inform you about a program that we've had in Lane County Jail for many years now. And Judge Aiken spoke about responsivity, and this is actually a very important component of that. And so here we go. So our program goals, or stated goals, is that this is program is directly to reduce recidivism and support economic development of Lane County. And it's for enhancing opportunities for ex-offenders and reducing that criminal behavior, increasing family wage income, and contributes to the tax base, and which reduces dependency on government services. And that's really what it's all about. Government services includes everything from the street officer and making arrests and the contact of the parole, probation, everybody. If we can reduce that demand, and I think that Judge Aiken hit on it very well, is we do things backwards, and I think this program has been trying to front load for a long time, but we haven't had that support. What it boils down to is I think everybody in this room knows that the more a person achieves education, the less likely they are to offend. And so if we have a bunch of folks that keep offending, then what it appears that we need to do is provide some education for those folks so they stop that behavior. We have many partners in this program. Again, this program is we've had in place. Actually, Judge Aiken helped start it. I didn't want to age you too much, but over 25 years ago. And we've had it in place, and it's had different forms of funding during this time. But we, as you can see, we've got many partners in our community, and they've been dedicated for assisting us in this endeavor. we achieve our goals basically through the advancement of education for the inmates, and regardless of their levels, we have many inmates that come in, and some of them haven't even gotten to high school yet, and yet they're already adults, and some of them want to further their education, have gotten their GEDs or have obtained their high school diplomas, but they want to go to college, and they have not had that extra push or the assistance on really how to, because like I said earlier, this is some of it causes a lot of anxiety. And actually, I'll share a conversation with you that I had with a person that's incarcerated, and he just got out of prison for a robbery charge, and what amazed him the most about getting out was that he got this phone from his girlfriend, and it had no buttons on it. And he couldn't figure out how to make this glass thing work, and all of a sudden he started sliding his fingers across and said, "Hey, this starts doing things," and he had no idea what it was, and he wasn't gone that long. He was in prison for like 4 years. So that gives you an idea of where these folks are at. They need to have some sort of bridge to get them caught up. We teach the basic, give them basic learning skills, including parenting skills that are so important. Technology skills, we have people that we have a classroom that is down at the Lane County Jail at the Sherman Center, and we have workstations, and we teach them basic computer skills that many of them have missed out on, or they need to advance their own ability to use those to their advantage to help them gain jobs. And we do resume building classes. We provide job search techniques, and we partner with Lane Transit District and get tokens and bus passes and whatnot, so they can have the transportation to go and find these jobs. We provide college and vocational applications and placement opportunities by partnering with a local cable company. We're able to get very, very low-cost internet access, and they can start applying for different grants and put in for different schools, and we've been very successful there. We've also have gotten very engaged in the placement of the National Career Readiness Certificate Program. Most folks are aware of that program now. It's come off to a slow start, and this provides a gap between a high school diploma and a person that has not obtained it, and it's not quite a GED, so it gives them something to show some sort of advancement, and they can show an employer that they're doing something. And then we're also providing personal finance skills training. Most of these folks have had no parenting in that area and do not know how to keep a balance in their checkbooks, if they even have a checkbook. This program supports legislative goals to reduce overcrowding in our jail system. We're trying to reduce the poverty, reduce adult and juvenile crimes, increase our intervention, and by decreasing incarceration and decreasing the amount of offenders on parole and probation, and encourage independent living. We do that in a sense that, again, if we provide them the tools, and I jotted down a note that I tend to liken those as providing survival skills training for these folks. They're literally in a survival mode, and they won't survive if they don't have the tools. It's the gentleman that indicates you keep doing the same thing over and over and expect a different outcome is crazy. Mm-hmm. Facts about our program is that we have offered this program year-round. We offer it an opportunity to all eligible offenders to earn their GED and or their NCRC program. We prepare the offenders to live and work in our community without engaging in criminal behavior, and provides offenders a path to our program and ultimately career training at Lane Community College or other secondary schools. And in part of that, when they start to see that they have a tangible goal, and you provide incentives, like was mentioned, you know, our incentive in our program, the biggest one is that if a person's got a sentence and they have 60 days left on the sentence, we do a risk assessment on them and ask them what do they need to survive when you get out. And we look to see if they have a GED or a high school diploma. And frankly, I don't know, I'm confident everybody in this room knows that if you try to go apply for a job and they have that little checkbox, do you have a high school diploma, and they can't checkmark that, they're not going to get hired. We incentivize a program by saying, well, tell you what, if you want to engage in our program, we will let you report here every single day as a day of reporting, and we will relieve you of a day of your sentence for each day you come in. Mm-hmm. And what did we just do? We opened up a space in our jail. We've got plenty of space. It's premium space. Unfortunately, we don't have many people to supervise. We have a 500-bed capacity jail, and right now we've got a little over 200 people incarcerated there. And just throw a number out to you is that on average we book in, or there's about 14,000 bookings a year, so you pick which 202 people are the worst, and that tells you about what the population is. So we're in a crisis situation, but this is a great way on the county level to minimize the amount of people are incarcerated, and I think if we can curb that tide of people coming into the system, it's going to relieve overcrowding at all levels. Some highlights of our fiscal year 11 and 12, we had 322 inmates have received almost 1,300 hours of professional instruction. I mean professional instruction because this program, we have LCC faculty members or certified instructors come in. We had five of them coming into the jail every single day to work with this population. 303 GED subtests were successfully passed by that group of people. 73% of the inmates earn their GED, and I'm not sure about what the stats are for local schools, but I've been advised by people at LCC that is an incredibly high number. 21% of those students continued on to college classes at LCC after completing their sentences, and I can tell you for a fact that last year we had three people that asked to have their sentences extended so they can stay. Mm-hmm. They begged their parole and probation officer, please sanction me again. Do you want me to go out and give you a dirty UA? They were begging to come in. We worked it out. He didn't go out and do that. But this is huge for them. Mm-hmm. I'm going to show you a couple. The Judge Aiken had mentioned a couple of the golden nuggets, and I instantly thought about these people. And if you can take a look at their eyes, and also I included some folks that have. These are all people that have obtained their GEDs, and I've included some of their booking photos to show you, you know, a little bit of the difference. It's incredible to see the satisfaction, and I got to tell you, for almost an entire career in law enforcement, it thrills me to no end to see people like this and turn things around and me be able to see them in a grocery store and ask how they're doing, and they actually run up to me and tell me how they're doing. It's amazing. There's some more folks. If you notice the bottom left corner, that's pretty impressive. I added this a little bit of a story. This woman was 34 years old when. And I was there when she got presented this. She was 34 years old when her parents said, don't contact me again, ever. We're tired of you calling us. We're tired of you taking from us. We're tired of you victimizing us. Don't get a hold of us until you do something useful in our life. On that day, she was 51 years of age. Hadn't talked to them in 17 years, and she broke down crying when she got that GED. And I asked her, I said, why are you so upset or crying so much? And she said that she couldn't wait to call her parents that night. So I just want to put a little human factor to it. This gentleman, he's actually pretty enjoyable to be around. He has no new charges. He's parole and probation conditions have been met, and he's currently full-time employed. He's been out of the program for a couple of years now. You may even recognize him. Mm-hmm. So we spoke of, the governor spoke many times on regarding Senate Bill 253 and 909 in regards to 40-40-20. I'm confident everybody here knows about that. Those are awesome goals, but without any doubt, the offender population in Oregon is educationally and vocationally underserved. Without programs like the one in Lane County, this aggressive statewide goal just simply cannot be made. Data collected from Oregon Department of Corrections indicate that 47% of offenders entering the system do not have a high school diploma or a GED. 47%. That 15% of those were less likely to recidivate than those that did not. So those folks that entered the educational program aren't coming back to the correction system. You're talking about overcrowding, and education, I believe, is absolutely the key.
If I can be so bold, what I would tell you is our educational incentive person, Diane Hochstein, and another chair of the criminal law committee from Florida, the three of us were asked to present to all the wardens in the United States on our educational incentive program, because that's it's clear that the lessons people can learn about education are sitting in the prisons. And so we're the ghost of Christmas future for education, and there are so many lessons out of what we're seeing. But the education issue is tremendous.
So I guess the bottom line is that educational and workforce development programs work. And again, thank you for letting me be here. And I do want to extend an invitation to this entire committee to come down to our facility, and I'd be happy to show you exactly what we've put together, have scrounged together. I've got computer screens that I've taken from the courts. the courts have donated. And some computer PC consoles that the city of Springfield has donated. We put this together, just scratched it together, and have made it work. And we're willing to do that and continue to maximize resources that are available.
Well, we're here to give you some more resources, so thank you very much. Representative Hicks.
So I'll ask two questions together. First, one of the reasons I asked you to come down, Joe, was because you have empirical data. This is a program that's pretty established. You've been tracking these people for a long time. And to the extent you could just briefly cover some of your empirical results of how this works out, could you please? And also, could you describe the system of video lottery dollars?
Right. On the data that I've put together, I think you have got the documents that I provided earlier in regards to our program and its outcomes. It's the great thing about the program is that it's all measurable, and you can determine its success, and you can tweak it as you go. I would refer you to page 3, and also I'd also like to refer you to Oregon Benchmark 27 under adult literacy. This program is spot on when it comes to providing adult literacy to a group of population that is underserved and to be productive working members of our community. I think Representative Hicks, you're referring to on my page 6 in regards to outcomes, or are you talking about costs?
Well, first outcomes, then
costs.
But, yeah.
So basically what we're indicating here is that I guess per dollar or per capita, when we have that type of instructor to offender relationship, we got three instructors in a classroom of sometimes of 16 offenders. And these are professional instructors. Plus, I supplement them as another one of my duties. I'm a special services officer. One of my duties is to I coordinate all the volunteers for the corrections division. I have tutors that are credentialed tutors that come in as well. So we have up to 5, even 6 people that are instructing 16 people at the max. We split that group up because we know that we lose those people within about 3 to 4 hours. We start to lose them, so to speak. So we doubled up and have the instructors there all day, but we have an afternoon session that comes in. So we're able to bring in 32 or 36 people then each day. With those instructors that come in, most of them, again, or half of them, again, are volunteers. The other ones are part-time instructors with LCC. So we're able to get that type of one-on-one contact. And so I think that's why our numbers, our GED attainments and the test success stories are so high. Another incentive that we provide, too, is that once an inmate or an offender enters our program, we pay for their subtests, which is, you know, there's 5 for each one. That alone, you would be absolutely shocked to know how many people, when they get out of the jail, they want to get their GED, but then they go and they walk up and say, okay, I want to take my GED test, and they say, well, it'll be this much money. And they look at them and that's more money than I can afford. And they're done. There's no waivers, there's no decreases. They're done. The neat thing about this, at least in our level, at the county level, we don't have people very long term, but we get them in our program. But once those sub tests are paid for, if we can get them in to 1 or 2 or 3, when they get released, those sub tests are all paid for at once. so they can actually get out of our program and continue on and have those sub-tests paid for and be successful and gain their GED after even they're out of our day reporting program.
You can have light bulbs go off. So, what's so funny is when I toured the jail for the first time after becoming a judge in 1988, Richard...
Minor?
Dick Minor took me on a tour. He's a transport deputy. Took me on a tour, and he said, you know, there's the most amazing thing that happens when someone gets a GED. It's everything shuts down. We have a big celebration, and it is a big deal. And you know what? I never see those guys back here. And I said, so, Dick, what are we going to do? We got to do this. And he goes, well, we're out of money. So it took us 2 years, but we were able to access the collect call money to be designated for the GED class and build from there. But I thought, that's 1988. That was a transport deputy just making that observation. I said, why aren't we doing more of this? And it's every judge position I've held and every opportunity in juvenile, state court, or federal, that education, if you can get engage people and help them through whatever strategies have not worked or address their issues and get them the vision help or the auditory processing or whatever it takes, we are able to turn people around. And so I've just been thrilled to have a longstanding relationship with the jail.
It's been great. As far as you mentioned,
what's your recidivism rate and who pays for this? Let me ask it that way.
My recidivism rate, I can tell you, and this last school year, I went ahead and I printed out the criminal histories of every individual in our program physically. And I know it probably shouldn't have based on the paper, but I needed to know in my hand what it was like. And I printed those all out, and I separated that stack by who went through the program and who has not been arrested since they left the program, and who has been arrested or reoffended since the program. And the stack on the left, out of a 5-inch stack, was about 3.5 inches thick. The stack on the right of the folks that have reoffended was about 1 inch thick. Some of them actually hadn't been out of the system yet to reoffend, but I considered them still part of the system. That's just the physical part of it right there. So I guess it's very hard to quantify recidivism rate. Okay. But I can tell you in the near future, it's very impactful. I think you have to go back probably 3 years, maybe 4 years, to find out if you really have had a behavioral change. As far as costs are concerned, it runs somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000 a year, which is a significant amount of money. However, if you look at the numbers, when we have a capacity or running a capacity of clearly 400 individuals in a year and can have the capacity of up to 500 individuals a year, that's $1,000 a year to provide this type of tool, survival skills tool, so they don't come back. And that, I would submit, is extremely inexpensive. When you go back to those bookings I was referring to at the jail, each individual booking occurrence costs the citizens, and Senator Przanski, you may have heard this before, is somewhere in the neighborhood of between $475 and $600 of taxpayers' monies just for the booking process, the officer's time, the arrest, the reports, the deputy's time, the booking time, the court clerk's time, the judge's time, all of it is $500 to $700 a piece times 14,000.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Chair. Let me see if I can get this right. Piscinari?
Awesome. Perfect.
Okay. I'm a former educator, so this is very encouraging. It's very heartening to see these inmates be able to achieve this. However, as a representative of the people, I have to be concerned about costs. So I'm looking at your book, and you're saying you would need $500,000 per year to do this. It looks like you had 322 people. Is that how many you would be doing in a year?
No, that's for fiscal year 11-12, and so I believe our capacity for that program can be bumped up to close to 500 without too much difficulty.
Okay. Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
So you're thinking around $1,000 per person. You know, I just think it needs to be pointed out that the student goes to community college for a term. they're paying just slightly more than that for a full term. So it seems to me your costs are a little bit high. If you extrapolate that for 36 counties, that would be $18 million, I believe. I don't know if that would be prorated, but by size of the county. But could you address that? Because I think your costs are high for this.
Sure. We're talking about an offender population, and the offender population does need supervision. They are. It's you can't place offenders into a facility and have civilian folks working there without some sort of security available. These people that we, part of the incentivized program is that, like I said, we allow them to go home at night. These people experience life between each class session, and that population is in a situation where we're not sure how they're going to be coming back the next day or what situation they are. We've had a few situations where we've had to intervene with security staff. So we need to have security staff present based on the size of that group. So there's a cost there. And I think, too, is that our capacity is probably greater than most counties, certainly not all counties, but I believe that my guess it would have to be prorated in a sense of the participation levels.
Sure, Paula.
So
you're saying these students they're not in the jail, they're not getting room and board, so to speak. You're not feeding them, is that correct?
Well, we do. We actually, we're not feeding them full-on meals because we're having a morning session and an afternoon session, so we don't have the statutory obligation to provide a hot meal. But we do provide snacks because a lot of these folks aren't eating. But we do provide snacks, and that's actually another, seems silly, but it's part of the incentivizing. They enjoy coming in. So our kitchen does prepare some snacks while they're there, and they take breaks. The incarceration part of it is when you refer to people that are incarcerated in jail, it costs the county at approximately $129 a day per person.
I think she's not understanding that you have an RRC. There's distinctions between your facilities. That they're coming and going. I don't think that's clear.
Yes. Actually, I'm sorry. You're correct. These people, our population, it's not like the same person. Like Johnny Smith is not going to start the school year and be with us for the year. They're coming and going. This is an extremely dynamic group, and so we may have some people there for 2 or 3 months and start up with another person right after that to take their spot in the seat. So that whole classroom is flux, and that's where all these people are coming from, and are basically kickstarting all these individuals and getting them into the system, getting them employed, and getting them into the schools.
In other words, he's serving more people, but they're coming in sequential fashion, and then they're transitioning out to Lane Community College. It's
right.
The kickstart to the community college. So the numbers they serve are broader, but so that when they finish through the jail, it's a smaller number because they're kickstarted and moved them out to the community college. I mean, we're having to make jails these multi-discipline kind of facilities to meet the different needs and to use the space really smart. And so that's just one of the ways in which we get people motivated to end up back out of the community college.
Yes, and we this last year, too, partnered with Lane Workforce Partnerships and Lane Community College, and we have people to reduce our overcrowding and to reduce our, to increase space in that room. We transitioning several of those folks into the National Career Readiness Certificate program out at Lane Community College, and they're serving their sentences at LCC.
Thank you.
Senator Brzozowski, and then I want to thank you both very much for taking the time to be here tonight and share these experiences. We'll move now to the second topic. And thank you, Representative Hicks, for initiating this conversation. We're going to move to presentation on House Bill 3194 on the issue of enhancing evidence-based, cost-effective community supervision practices. And I'll ask Ted Smetana, Abe Huntley, and Laura Ritchie to come forward, please.
Who would have ever thought education had a value in people's lives?
Some.
We've been telling people that kids so good. How important it is.
It's true.
But it's also a question
of
family of our public schools. They needed them.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, member of the committee, members of the committee. My name is Ted Smetana. I'm the director of Yam Hill County Community Corrections. I've been there for close to 5 years, and prior to that, was with Marion County for about 25 years in adult community corrections. I'm here today to discuss the procedural issue of the process of setting probation conditions for adult persons on felony supervision in Oregon. It's Section 11 of House Bill 3194. Currently in Oregon, conditions of probation which drive the programming and services for an offender are set by the court at the time of sentencing. That is often done, of course, based on the nature of the crime. A person convicted of a drug offense will most likely get an obligation to complete drug treatment, which is certainly appropriate. But what we find over the last 10 years or so, with community corrections really focusing on evidence-based practices and risk and needs assessment, that we're assessing folks, and we're assessing 8 criminogenic risk and need factors in most counties. And 4 of those, through research, have been proven to be most critical, or the 4 areas where, when you target those areas, you're going to get the best bang for your buck, so to speak, in terms of reduced recidivism. And that's history of antisocial behavior, antisocial personality or temperament, antisocial attitudes, values or beliefs, and antisocial peers or companions. So you can see the theme here. It's about criminality, and criminal thinking is, we've discovered, to be the most critical thing. So there's not been a way, and we're not certainly critical of the courts, but there's never been a way for us to inform the court about these risk and need factors so that those conditions can be created and those issues can be addressed during the period of community supervision. So we have found over the last several years that we are assessing individuals, we're creating case plans, and then we find that those case plans aren't always congruent with the conditions of supervision that were ordered by the court. Or sometimes the conditions of supervision ordered by the court, and this can vary by county. Some counties already have unconditioned packages where they kind of just give the laundry list of any possible problem and any possible condition that can be thought of, and those are imposed on these offenders. And frankly, we find that many of those don't turn out to be appropriate or necessary, and we find that they really overwhelm the offender. I've seen people that have over 100 conditions of supervision due to one criminal offense. Research has shown us that conditions of supervision should be based on risk and need factors as identified through a criminogenic risk and need assessment. In 2011, the Board of Parole recognized this fact and, through an administrative process, shifted the responsibility of condition setting for parolees to the local supervisory offices. So we now do our risk and needs assessment. We determine the conditions of supervision and report that back to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Section of HB 3194 would basically do the same thing. It would allow community corrections to assess folks after sentencing and then determine the conditions of supervision and then file that back with the court. We think that's a very appropriate and evidence-based practice, and we think will lead to much more effective conditions of supervision that should be much more effective in reducing recidivism for that group of individuals. Yam Hill County, we've had our own kind of special take on this practice. If I may just take a moment to explain that. In 2010, we were granted a technical assistance grant by the National Institute of Corrections, and it was called the Evidence-Based Decision-Making Initiative. And the purpose of that initiative was to expand the use of evidence-based practices all the way throughout our local criminal justice system, through arrest, through prosecution, sentencing, local incarceration, possible prison incarceration, and then supervision afterwards, all the way up to termination. And one area we decided to focus on, actually 3 areas, pretrial services, evidence-based sentencing, and then appropriate evidence-based correctional treatment programs offered while on supervision. But in terms of evidence-based sentencing, we've developed a pilot project where we're actually assessing individuals in the same way, but we're doing it prior to sentencing. So we're getting in there, assessing these individuals using a battery of assessments, and then coming up with a condition package and reporting that back to the court that the court can impose at the time of sentencing. So it very much, it's a different process, but isn't very much in line with the concepts of House Bill 3194. I believe you have a copy of the template of that report. It's just a quick two-page. It's meant for speed. We put our conclusions right on the front, and we categorize our conditions. I knew I'd forget this unless I brought a copy. In terms of risk reduction targets, in other words, those kinds of programs that are intended to reduce a person's risk, and then risk management concerns. The difference being, for example, we don't need a risk assessment to tell us that a pedophile should not have contact with minors. That's a risk management issue. It's an appropriate condition. The court would impose it. We can impose it. But we're really trying to focus on the things that will reduce people's risk, and primarily those top four criminogenic factors that I mentioned. So we've been piloting this process now for about 6 months. We're doing two cases a week, which I know isn't a lot. But frankly, we think we're ready to expand it to all of our felony offenders being placed on probation in Yamhill County, but we simply haven't had the funds to do that. It's a pretty time-consuming process. I have one portion of one probation officer dedicated to do two of these assessments per week and report that back to the court. But we do certainly hope to, at some point in the near future, be able to expand that process to all of the cases being sentenced in our county. And that's all I have on this particular issue. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll finish the panel and we can take questions.
Okay. Good evening, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Abe Huntley. I'm the Director of Community Corrections in Josephine County. And I wanted to speak just briefly on earned discharge, part of the House Bill 3194, Section 27. Community Corrections uses a variety of tools to motivate offenders under our supervision to comply with those conditions set on them by the courts or the parole board, and ultimately change their behavior. Changing behavior as opposed to simply supervising or monitoring is hard work, but the outcomes are lasting and impactful to the community, and the savings are usually immeasurable. As a state, we are successful in approximately 70% of the offenders placed under our supervision. In keeping with best practices, one of the most powerful tools we have is the ability to motivate, provide incentives, and reward positive behavior, not just punish negative behavior, which the criminal justice system has always been good at. Some of the examples on a small scale, how it works on a ground level in Josephine County, for example, Josephine County, home of Dutch Brothers Coffee, I might add. We give coffee cards. We purchase coffee cards. We give coffee cards to offenders for through treatment, for periods of sobriety, for good attendance, different benchmarks. On a larger, more formal scale, we decrease supervision for those that are doing well and reduce reporting requirements for those offenders that have earned the low and limited risk status or those that were assessed at low risk at initial intake. This again provides motivation to comply, and it frees up valuable parole and probation officer time to be devoted to the more high-risk population of offenders. We've also learned through research that we can increase recidivism by over-treating and over-supervising our low-risk offenders and mixing our high-risk and low-risk offenders, that population. Low and limited-risk offenders, as you know, tend to get better by themselves. They're more pro-social, and the more we interfere with their lives, sometimes we can make the matters worse. A good share of this population have accomplished their supervision goals, such as treatment completion, sobriety, or the financial obligations such as restitution, yet we continue to keep them on supervision simply because we are funded according to the number of felony cases that we supervise or under our control in our counties. Using the earned early discharge model in this bill gives the offender the ultimate incentive for compliance and behavior change, the ability to exit the criminal justice system according to their individualized supervision plan and behavior, not based on a grid block with an arbitrary number of months that's attached. The evidence and the practice supports this model, and the resource savings can be shifted to the high-needs, high-risk population that demand our attention for the sake of public safety. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, good evening, co-chairs, members of the committee, not the board. My name is Laura Ritchie. I'm a senior district manager for Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I've worked there for almost 27 years, all of my adult life, and I've been in this business both prior to implementing best practices and prior to implementing administrative sanctions in post. So I've seen both sides of this business before and after. Multnomah County Department of Community Justice supports this bill, and I'm here to specifically talk about Section 10, administrative sanctions, and how including defamation cases makes sense and why. In 1993, we began utilizing administrative structure sanctions in Oregon, and we've been using this, what is a best practice of swift and certain sanctioning since then for 20 years. We've had a lot of success with that, and I'll talk about that. I won't talk too long, but I will talk about that. And we know that right now there's about 10 states across the country looking to implement administrative sanctions, and they're looking at Oregon and how we've done that as a way to utilize this practice in their states. In Multnomah County, we supervise about 8,000 offenders at any given time. Last year, I ran the numbers, and last year we administered over 7,987 sanctions, which was 90% of the sanctions on offenders that were eligible for administrative sanctions. That would be excluding cases where the courts retained authority. They said no structured sanctions. Our probation officers are trained to use a wide array of sanctions to address violation behavior, and that would include things like community service, day reporting center, work crews, curfew, electronic monitoring, GPS, things like that, and including jail. And we find that using alternative sanctions, sometimes coupled with jail, sometimes not, is more effective in changing offender behavior than jail time alone. I believe I handed you our administrative sanctioning grid. I don't know if you have that. Yep. That's the grid that we use in Multnomah County when we're sanctioning our offenders. That grid was built using sentencing guidelines, the crime seriousness scale, 1, 2, and 3, offender risk, utilizing validated risk pools, and behavior level, so the type of violation they commit. And we align all those three things together to determine what our ceiling for what a response to a violation could be. The ceiling of jail days, or how much time we can do with alternative sanctions. When we impose administrative sanctions, we always notify the judge and the DA so they have time to review our sanctions. I think the current statute gives them 4 days, but this is different. And on post-prison and parole cases, we exclusively use alternative sanctions, and we always notify the parole board. So that's all those cases, which are presumably the highest risk cases, are subject to structured sanctions. So you have a copy of our sanctioning grid. Again, we've been using this model for about 20 years successfully. Why we use structured sanctions is, it ensures consistency. So like offenders who committed like crimes, who have like risk scores, who commit like behaviors, have very similar responses to those behaviors. We believe that's important. This helps, one of the key things is probation officers are able to respond quickly to violation behavior. While problems are small, when things are just starting to go off the grid, officers can get involved and address violations. We know swift and certain is, research has shown that if you sanction quickly, if you address the violation quickly, you're more inclined to change behavior. Another thing is probation officers can be really clear with offenders. If you do this, this will happen. These are what the consequences are. It's kind of like parenting. You know, we do what we say we're going to do when the problem behavior occurs. We believe this is a really responsive responsible use of public dollars. We've saved, quite frankly, millions of dollars in Multnomah County in reduced uses of jail time. And I'm not saying we don't use jail time. Our length of stay is just shorter. In 2011, Multnomah County commissioners invested $1.2 million so that we could purchase alternative sanctions. We spent that money on electronic monitoring, increased capacity in our day reporting center, our community service programs, so that we would have more capacity to deal with problem offenders. We agreed to reduce some of our jail bed use in order to come up with that money. What we found was we were still using jail. We were using shorter length of stay. We saved approximately $8 million for the county in our lack of use of jail. So it was, the saving was not putting people in jail. And we looked at recidivism rates, and they did not go up. So we didn't compromise community safety. We're still holding offenders accountable. We know that we're still putting people in jail when the risk to the, when they pose a risk to the community. And longer jail sanctions do not change behavior. The additional savings that we see by doing alternative administrative sanctions is court staff time, indigent defense funds. We don't have to pay defense attorneys every time we do a sanction. And those are actually some pretty big savings. Best practices and structured sanctions. I've said it three times. Swift and sure, respond quickly for technical violations. We know that the least restrictive sanctions, we want to use the least restrictive sanctions to change offender behavior. We know that jail alone does not change offender behavior. We want to use jail when offenders pose a risk to the community, and we need to contain them, and we still do. But short jail sanctions coupled with alternatives and cognitive behavioral interventions actually do promote change. In Multnomah County, we implemented EPICS, which is Effective Practices in Community Supervision. It's a case management model that was developed by Dr. Ed Latessa out of University of Cincinnati. It was born out of Core Correctional Practices, which Dr. Andrews and Kit Kiesling, I believe, developed, and it's all research around changing offender behavior. There are two key components in this case management model, which is, we don't have enough time for me to explain the whole. It's very exciting, and I'd love to come tell you all about it. But the two components that are really specific to sanctioning are effective use of authority and effective disapproval. And those both say if you address problem behavior quickly, swiftly, and you do what you say you're going to do, recidivism is reduced 25%. And those are all built into this ability to administratively sanction offenders. Again, in keeping with EPICS and what we heard earlier, that use of incentives are really important, and we know that reinforcement and catching offenders doing things right and reinforcing that behavior is just as important in changing behavior. So we believe that incentives, like Abe talked about, really important, the long-term ones, but also just short-term incentives. Good job. Bus tickets, tangible, intangible, catching people doing things right. I believe it's 7 positives to 1 negative. So we spent a lot of time looking for people doing something right. The proposed benefits, we'll continue to use best practices, swift and certain, dealing with the violations early. The court will still be retain the ability to sanction when new crimes are committed, when risks are increased, when probation officers return cases to the court when there's a problem, or we notice there's community safety's compromised. Currently, structured sanctions, administrative sanctions are being applied to all post-prison parole cases. In our county, a lot of probation cases. There's still some cases that the court retains authority. In short, structured sanctions have saved millions of public dollars, and we think it can save more. So thank you for the opportunity to be with you tonight.
Thanks very much to the three of you. And then we'll have some questions. I have one for you to start. Have you seen cases where the offender was precluded from being on structured sanctions, where you and your expertise were confident that if that option had been available, you know, we could have dealt with that offender in a more cost-effective and
Absolutely.
Effective way.
What I didn't say and what I had wanted to say was when offenders are prohibited from structured sanctions, often they have to go, we either get a warrant, they go to jail, we write a letter to the court talking about the violation. It takes them a week to 10 days to see a judge. So every protective factor that they ever had, a job, housing, any treatment they were involved in, gets very interrupted, if not lost. So it's almost a disincentive to address some of those violations because we know these guys need to be employed. We know they need to be educated. We know they need to be in programming. It's sometimes very, very causes great disruption in their life when it's precluded, when we can't administer sanctions.
Other questions? Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, thank you. Ted, in your description of what you're doing this work up to give to the court, to me is, I guess I'm going to say, a modified reduced PSI of what we used to have before we went to mandatory minimum sentencing.
Exactly. We initially talked about calling it a pre-sentence assessment package, but decided the acronym wasn't so good, so we went to case analysis.
It got the point across.
But it very much is that, except that the PSI was very much a lot about professional discretion and a lot of recording of history and facts, which has its place. But this is more about an approach to really look at it. It's more of a diagnostic or insightful way
to
look at an offender.
And that's based on, as you said, the assessments, et cetera.
Correct. And we actually do in this process a battery of assessments. We assess people's motivation. We assess the criminogenic risk factors. We assess their substance abuse. Not an in-depth alcohol evaluation, but we use a screening tool to get a sense of where we stand. And we do if appropriate, a brief mental health screening as well.
Thank you.
Just on that note, could you give a couple examples of the types of, if you use the wrong conditions of supervision for the wrong person without the benefit of a kind of a risk assessment, what are some of the things that can go sideways?
Well, I can't off the top of my head think about a condition that was wrong that caused damage, but I think I can think of it in terms of conditions that just didn't exist, that were necessary. Very often we rely very much on substance abuse treatment, and that certainly is an important factor for many of our offenders. But if you don't address the criminality and the criminal thinking, even if you succeed in addressing a substance abuse problem, you've got someone who's no longer abusing substances but still has criminal thinking and criminal orientation, maybe criminal peers and associates, which never works well in the long term.
Right.
I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, and I think you also said there are times when you have people who are truly low risk who, if we over-supervise, it can be counterproductive.
Very much so.
I was hoping you could say a little bit more about that.
You mentioned that, but I find it to be exactly the same thing. It was a hard concept for us, of being a person who, like Laura, has been around a long time. It seemed very intuitive to me and many of us that we've got to intervene with these low-risk people or else they're going to turn into high-risk people.
Right.
Well, the evidence has shown no, that actually they do tend to take care of themselves. They're more pro-social. The more we interrupt their lives, disrupt their employment, disrupt their family, and mixing them with high-risk people, which we always used to do a lot of, and so that they're exposed to even more criminality and criminal thinking, has a negative effect. And research has shown we actually can and often do, or did, increase their recidivism risk.
Thank you. All right. Committee, panel, thank you very much for your time.
A pleasure.
Thank you. Appreciate
you
being here. We really value it. And given the hour, I'm going to carry over the last part of our agenda with Mr. Prinz, and we'll just do that on Friday as time permits. So thanks, everybody, for being here. Committee, thank you. We're adjourned.